Hello and welcome to the MDS podcast, the official podcast of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society. Today we're in the second episode of the Myoclonus special series. I am Marina de Koning-Thijssen, I'm a neurologist and head of the Expertise Center of Movement Disorders in Groningen, the Netherlands. And I'm here today with two guests, Anna Latorre, consultant neurologist at the Department of Clinical and Movement Neurosciences, Queen Square, London, and Shabir Merchant, assistant professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School and Beth Israel Diakoness Medical Center. Anna was trained at the University of Sapienza in Rome and later worked with Kailash Bhatia and John Roswell at Queen Square. She's a member of the MDS Clinical Neurophysiology Study Group and recently became the first author of a paper of that study group on using electrophysiology to assess jerky movements. Shabir trained with Professor Stanley Fan at Columbia University and completed a fellowship with Professor Mark Hallett at the NIH in Washington before moving to Harvard. He was the founding co-chair of both the MDS Clinical Neurophysiology Task Force and Study Group. Both Anna and Shabir have a strong interest in clinical neurophysiology for movement disorders, focusing on objective diagnosis, phenotyping, and enhancing the understanding of the pathophysiology. The topic of today is electrophysiology with a focus on cortical myoclonus. Anna and Shabir, welcome. I would like to start with the first question, and perhaps Anna, you can start there. What are the clinical phenotypes of the different anatomical forms of myoclonus? Can you say something about that?
Yes, thank you. I think that one of the most fascinating aspects about myoclonus is that it can arise from different parts of the nervous system, central and peripheral, and this makes the clinical presentation incredibly varied and sometimes tricky to localize. But traditionally, myoclonus has been classified anatomically into cortical, subcortical, including basal ganglia such as in myoclonus distoni or brainstem myoclonus, spinal, including sedimental and proprio-spinal, and peripheral types. However, more recently, it has been proposed a new myoclonus consensus with a new anatomophysiological classification, which is slightly different and includes the cortical, subcortical, brainstem, spinal, proprio-spinal, peripheral, and functional myoclonus. I think it's important just to highlight two aspects. One is the introduction of cortical-subcortical category, which is a bit new for movement disorder experts, but it reflects a physiological distinct phenomenon with excessive bidirectional neural activity between cortical and subcortical circuitry as seen in myoclonic epilepsy. And secondly, also the addition of a functional myoclonus, which is rather an etiological rather than a strictly anatomical category, but it was included because of its clinical relevance and the presence of distinct neurophysiological markers.
And Shabir, can you reflect a bit on how you would use electrophysiology to discriminate between the different types of myoclonus?
Yeah, thank you, Anna. That was a very excellent overview, so it makes things much easier for me. But thank you for inviting me for this important discussion and to be able to give a few of my opinion and share my experience with it. I think what Anna puts it is very good in terms of the classification, in terms of localization. I think from a practical standpoint, and that's what Marina, with your help and mentorship, we've been trying to make things easier in terms of how we can incorporate all these interesting ideas and input from the pathophysiology into daily clinical practice. So to simplify, I think the approach which we want to put forward to the practitioner is that the approach to diagnose these movements is very simple. I think the idea is that if you have a couple of surface electrodes, you can put it in certain body regions. That itself is so much more sensitive and specific compared to our current approach, where any jerk-like movement which we see is mislabeled, I would say, myoclonus. Because I personally think that myoclonus should be a physiologic diagnosis. What you describe as phenomenology can be jerky movements. It can be from many different things, and many different things look like the same. So I think when we use the term myoclonus, and I'm hoping that we start to use an objective way in which we describe, when we use the term or qualify the term myoclonus, it is qualified with certain spatial and temporal aspects of the movement recorded. So I'll give you a very simple example for the category of cortical and subcortical myoclonus. If you apply a couple of surface electrodes to your forearm, because the cortical myoclonus distribution, usually you want to involve the face and the arm. So just by putting a couple of surface electrodes in the arm, if you record simultaneous agonist-antagonist activity at a burst duration around 50 milliseconds or so, or even if you go up to 100 milliseconds, if the burst duration is simultaneous agonist-antagonist activity in a muscle, it cannot be anything but a cortical or subcortical myoclonus. You have ruled out a functional jerk, you have ruled out startle-related problem, you have ruled out or spinal-related pathologies, just by doing a very simplistic way of doing this. Again, then you can qualify that by localizing it. You can do all these studies of back averaging, looking at the origin within the nervous system. But I'm saying just by looking at these very simple burst duration, the localization of the burst, and if you have a generalized jerky movement, by applying electrodes in the different cranial nerves and the muscles of the axial and appendicular skeleton, and just by looking at the time duration it takes from traveling of the body from one location to the other, it gives you a very simple idea about the pathway in the nervous system this jerky movement is traveling through. And that itself will give you a very good diagnosis in terms of whether this is a jerky movement from a reticular system originating from a reticular myoclonus, which is a brainstem related problem, or if your most favorite thing is startle myoclonus, which can originate a little bit in the pons, and the velocity of conduction of those volleys is a little bit different. So I think by using very simple measures of just looking at this recorded movement in a very simplistic way, you can improve the diagnostic accuracy. And one of the largest series which produced just in about close to 90% of the diagnosis of cortical myoclonus can be made just on the basis of this very simple measure of recording simultaneous agonist-antagonist activity and looking at the burst duration. So that's the approach that we need to educate and say so that it can be easily incorporated into the clinical practice.
Thank you, Shabir. And then, Anna, I liked the idea of Shabir just using simple EMG registrations on one hand to see the simultaneous burst activity. But how would you discriminate between cortical and subcortical? Because that makes a difference in how you would subsequently try to find the cause of the myoclonus. Can you say something about that?
Yes, of course. I think the most challenging differential diagnosis is indeed often between cortical and subcortical. And as Shabir has well said, EMG can be an important tool to start with. But sometimes things are a little bit more complicated. So we look for signs of cortical hyperexcitability, so to confirm or exclude the possible cortical origin. And to do that, normally we measure somatosensory bulk potential, long latency reflexes, and we also do EEG-EMG simultaneous recording to apply techniques such as jerk lock back averaging and cortical muscular coherence. And in this case, we can have different findings depending indeed if the origin is cortical or subcortical.
I agree with you. So you say there is a lot of additional testing, but if you would just use the EMG, would you think it would also be possible? Perhaps I give that back to Shabir. Yeah. Do you think that's also possible to discriminate between cortical and subcortical?
I think to a certain extent, yes, Marina. And I think if it is a very, usually the subcortical volleys, because of the bilateral nature and the diffuse nature of the spread, you tend to not have it more focal or lateralized or localized like you have with cortical myoclonus when you see a lot of it neurodegenerative dementias and things like that, where you usually have it, the face and the arm distribution is very clear. But I just add one thing to Anna's thing. I think the issue with recording all of these techniques, back averaging, doing long loop reflexes and corticomuscular coherence, is that the sensitivity of them is very low. So now, if I'm relying on a test whose sensitivity is already low to differentiate a disorder which is already so complex between cortical and subcortical, so is it I'm classifying something to be cortical because I did not find what I wanted to find in my test, which was already not going to be very good. So for instance, for a simple recording like cortical back averaging for a cortical myoclonus, let's say if you were to back average the molecule, if the bursts are not very frequent, you can sit all day and try to get a back average of the cortical spike. And secondly, even if you do that very well, even despite that, sometimes you may not find a very good cortical spike or a cortical transient. So I have find it two ways. I think this exercise is very interesting with SEPs and things is very good because it gives you a very clear reading. The technique is well established. But with back averaging and other techniques, I think the problem is, to me, it's how good is the test to begin with, to then go on to use it to differentiate. So those are some of the challenges. And I think some of the interesting data, something like from your group, from a lot of other groups showing their experiences is helping really in terms of classifying and refining some of these classifications that we have. So it's lots to learn, like Anna said, but it's still evolving. But this very simplistic ways that can be very helpful.
You're saying it's not so sensitive, but when I think on the other hand, it's quite specific, right? If you don't find the cortical correlate, like Anna said, it does definitely support your idea. But if I would ask either of you, perhaps Anna, what do you think of the additional value of finding on your EMG a negative myoclonus? Does that help you?
Absolutely does, because I completely agree that the sensitivity can be variable, but this applies to most of the techniques. Indeed, also EGPAS, sometimes in cortical myoclonus could be longer. So I think that the combination of all these techniques is the most effective approach. And indeed, what you mentioned is very important, because often in cortical myoclonus, we see a combination of positive and negative myoclonus, where the negative myoclonus, it is a sort of silent period during a continuous EMG discharges, which lasted about 140 milliseconds. And when these are seen in combination together with the positive, is also strongly suggestive of a cortical origin.
And would the two of you, if you don't have the availability of all the additional tests, would you think that the coherence between two muscles might be of additional value here? Shabir, you're nodding.
Yeah, it could be helpful. Yeah. It could be helpful, especially if it's a generalized jerk. Again, I find it, the coherence by itself can be, to put a lot of value to it, I'm not really sure. I would put too much weight into finding coherence if the other aspects of the recording are not very clear. But it could be helpful, the cortical, especially when you have for something like cortical tremors, where the volleys are so frequent and so consistent and so fast, where it's very hard to find a cortical correlate. So in those specific scenarios where there are multiple bursts where we cannot back average, this technique is very important to find intermuscular as well as corticomuscular coherence. These techniques become very useful in terms of finding this increase in the power of the sensory motor bands of EEG.
I am interested in this, that we actually we don't know so much about the sensitivity and specificity. If we do find it, we are reassured. But Anna, do you know anything about the influence of medication on these tests?
Yeah, so there have been some reports, especially, for instance, also some new anti-epileptic drugs that often are used in cortical myoclonus for obvious reason from a pathophysiological point of view. There can be some changes in the finding, and this could be, of course, also medications such as clonazepam, which improves the myoclonus. So you might find different EMG outputs, but also, for instance, even the SEPs can be differentiated. Or there are some studies in the 80s where lisuride was given IV to dissociate the correlation between an EMG past and the giant SEPs, and there was some variable response. So for sure, there is an implication when we study patients under treatment in our findings, and this possibly has also affected our ability to determine the specificity, because most of the time we study them under treatment.
Yes, I understand. Yes. And then I'm interested in, this is my last question, do you consider cortical myoclonus part of epilepsy based on the electrophysiology or not? Perhaps, Shabir, I can ask you first, and I'm also interested in Anna's opinion.
Yeah, I would say it's a fragment of epilepsy. How about that? So
diplomatic, yeah.
Yes, so I would say it's a fragment of epilepsy. And I think Anna has put forward a very beautiful idea on a similar lines in her very nice review on cortical tremor, for instance, where it's a spectrum of disorders that you can have a single volley, you can have multiple volleys of the same cortical tremor. And then if it progresses, it can become into an epileptic disorder. So you can always think about these disinhibited problems of your cortical or subcortical regulators or places where some of these neural substrates can fire. Sometimes with the subcortical, it is the priming from the subcortical to the cortex. For instance, the reticular myoclonus is very nicely demonstrated in Dr. Hallett, the only good series that we know of in terms of that, where the cortical correlate is after the first myoclonus volley from the medullary origin. So again, there can be all this priming, even for subcortical myoclonus, that it can prime the sensory motor cortex through these aberrant plasticity mechanisms by these discharges. So I think it's hard to categorize into one or the other, but definitely you can call it that it's a fragment of epilepsy. And there is certainly, considering what we call as epileptic, that it originates in the nervous system spontaneously. So by that definition, yes, I would consider it to be, quote unquote, epileptic origin of this discharge.
And now, can I have your opinion as well?
Yes. So it should be nicely cited my ideas. I believe indeed that I think that all these phenomena, all these entities which go from reflex myoclonus going through cortical tremor, epilepsia partialis continua, up to myoclonic epilepsy, they share common mechanism, which is a pathological cortical discharges. But what differentiates them is how widespread and self-sustaining the activity is. So some remain focal and brief, others evolve into more complex epileptic pattern. So for sure there might be some differences in the spatial and temporal amplification of the disorder, but I think that the underlying mechanism are very similar, so I would consider this part of epilepsy. And if I may add, I think this is important because often, like myoclonus, like in the borderland between movement disorder and epilepsy, and often we tend not to talk to each other or to use different approaches or different terminology, which has created a bit of confusion, while I think we should try to have a more common idea and perspective on this disorder.
Sounds very good to me. Anna and Shabir, thank you so much for joining me today in this second episode of the Myoclonus Special series on electrophysiology. I think you gave some very nice insights in the way you're working, but also in all your knowledge about the pathophysiology. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The views and opinions expressed by the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the International Parkinson and Movement Disorder Society or their affiliated journals, Movement Disorders and Movement Disorders Clinical Practice. Any disclosures of the participants can be found within the episode description located on the MDS website.